Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. So today I'm really excited to have Jonathan Fields on the podcast. Jonathan is a dad, husband, serial entrepreneur, growth strategist, and award-winning author. He runs the Good Life Project, where he and his team lead a global community in the quest to live a more meaningful, connected, and vital life. His latest book is How to Live a Good Life, Soulful Stories, Surprising Science, and Practical Wisdom. Thanks for chatting with me today, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Oh man, I really enjoyed your book. I read it in one sitting. Cover to cover, it flows really naturally, but I know with the writing process, probably writing it doesn't flow as nicely as the final product looks.
Yeah, it's always an adventure, and I know you know that journey well yourself. And so two things. One, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Writing is always a really kind of interesting process. And two, knowing that you come from a background where, with really rigorous academic perspective on things that are legitimate and actionable, it was a really interesting challenge because writing this was, I wanted to take stuff where I knew that there was science behind so much of what I was trying to do, but deliver it in a way where it felt like it was easy, where it felt like you didn't have to work to understand the ideas in the book. You may have to do a bit of work to actually act on them, but I was really trying to create a way to share knowledge in a way that was it went down really easily and was just really actionable.
Yeah, and it clearly was. And you brought in a lot of positive psychology, I saw.
I did, that we share that love.
Yeah, no, it's great. And to be able to bring that from the scientific journal articles to the everyday household is no easy feat.
Yeah, I love the fact that the book resonated with you because what I was really trying to do was take some ideas that I knew were really worked and just distill them and serve them up in a way where it went down easy, but easy enough for people to look at and say, well, I could do that, and knowing that it would really matter if they did.
For sure. You must be in New York City because I hear fire engines in the background.
Indeed. I know. First, we have disconnection problems, and this is validation that, in fact, I am in the heart of Manhattan.
Well, let's talk about, I try to turn lemons into lemonade here. So you talk about the different buckets that we have that we do as well to assess how empty they are for us and take proactive steps to fill them. One of them is vitality. And in the vitality bucket, I noticed that you include resiliency in there. Is that right?
I do, yeah.
I thought that was really cool. I mean, we're going through some resiliency right now to get through this interview. For our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, we've been having some connection issues. So tell me a little bit why you decided to group together these things that you did under the vitality bucket. You also included optimism as well as mindfulness and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of the earliest decisions I had to make because when you look at almost everything that's written where people are trying to figure out how to sort of live an optimal life, generally they split out, they sort of split out your body and then they split out your mind or your mindset or your affect. And, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, I could see how that would be a legitimate dichotomy. But, all the research now just shows that it is such a falsehood to actually try and speak to them as two separate things. So when I think of vitality, what I think about is optimizing your state of mind and your state of body because they're one seamless feedback mechanism. I can't fathom how you could actually try and optimize your physical body without it having a profound effect on your psychological side of your existence, and how the same thing with, if you're really trying to optimize mindset, it has a profound effect on your body. So to speak about vitality as, okay, let's talk about your body and then let's talk about your mindset as two separate things, it just seemed like this complete and utter lie to me. So I said, we have to bring these all together because it's just one universal feedback mechanism.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, when we're feeling depressed or from feeling just like, I don't want to get, I don't want to do this day today. What's my reaction? It's to stay in bed all day. So that's a very physical reaction.
Yeah.
So the inverse of that must be true too. When I'm excited for the day, then I want to be vital.
Yeah, I mean, and look at the research that goes the other way now too. You know, like you've got like Amy Cuddy's work on how literally standing in a particular posture changes your state of mind, or you know, if you're physically ill or physically in pain or physically injured, it is going to trickle back up into your brain and into your psychology as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about just a couple things people can do to fill their vitality bucket without giving away too much. Can I choose some?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
So how can people make exercise more fun than sex?
Maybe the most provocative title in the whole book. You go for first. You know, it's really interesting. When we were kids, as a general rule, we exercise harder than your average adult will ever exercise. We got home from school, we ran around all day, we played, we were in the schoolyard, we did all sorts of things. We were moving our body literally until we just couldn't keep our eyes open, and then we dropped. You know, but back then we called it play and we couldn't get enough of it. And then you sort of zoom the lens up into, you know, quote, grown-up exercise. And everybody's sort of immediate response, with the exception of a small number of people, is, ugh, you know, this is something that I have to suffer through. It's something that I have to endure. I got really curious about why that is. You know, when did play turn into exercise? And when did something that we couldn't get enough of turn into something that we dreaded? And how did that happen? And from what I've seen, and I, you know, I have a background in the fitness industry and the health and fitness industry as an entrepreneur as well. And what I saw really quickly is that what we've done is essentially we've taken play, and as we've sort of, you know, industrialized fitness, we've taken the novelty out of it. We've taken this socialization out of it. We've taken all the things that would actually engage your mind in it, and we've kind of stripped it from it. So what we've left people with are monotonous, boring, repetitive motion movements that, of course, you know, like we dread. Because if you put the average 5-year-old on a treadmill and said, you know, like walk at 4 miles per hour for the next 40 minutes, they're going to last, you know, 4 seconds. And as adults, we're no different, you know. So the answer, sort of in industrial fitness, is, well, add in distraction and entertainment and then have people plug in, which then further isolates you from the community and basically strips all possibility of finding a sense of belonging and companionship as well. And it's really kind of tragic because it's taking something that innately, in its sort of like most natural form, we love and we can't get enough of, and it's fabulous for us. And it's basically taking all the things that make it wonderful and stripping it out and then forcing us back into a paradigm that doesn't work. So, you know, then along come a couple of players in the world who are starting to add it back in now. Places like CrossFit, places like Tough Mudder and all these endurance sort of like activities, Soul Cycle, who's sort of putting a different spin on indoor cycling, and all their sort of variations of that. And what they're realizing is they've got to bring the mind engagement part back into it. They have to bring the community back into it. And then, you know, when you bring people into the mix and then you bring the movement and the novelty, then you drop people into that, you know, like hyper-present awareness state. And then you bring people into the mix and you've got communal movement and the oxytocin starts flowing. And that's how you make it more fun than sex. And maybe it's not more fun.
Well, not all sex is necessarily fun. And not all. Right.
Right. So, but at least, you know, what you're doing is you're bringing movement back into your day in a way that it becomes a source of engagement and joy rather than something that you just like completely dread having to do.
How can you make it win-win and get good exercise from your sex?
Well, there's some interesting research that's been done on that, which kind of showed that, you know, on a calories burned perspective, it's probably measured in at about moderate exercise, although the average bout when measured in the research is also probably so short that it's probably not a good idea to make that your primary source of exercise, although certainly, you know, can be an enjoyable activity that you add into the mix.
Okay, fair enough. So yeah, I like that you talk about this body-mind connection and also exercise. You know, these buckets that you talk about feed into each other. They can interact and I guess ideally is integrating them in your life. So let's talk about gratitude, because that's, you know, Bob Emmons, others in the field of positive psychology have shown that's a big boon for well-being.
Yeah, it really is, right? And there seems to be so much research that's gone into it, although not always entirely reinforcing, you know, the different outcomes. You know, you had Seligman's, who, you know, obviously you work with, sort of earlier work, and then around gratitude journaling. But what we know is that, you know, in its various forms, done the way that works best for you, it is one of the most effective boosters of mood and mindset and affect. that we have available out there. And to build that into a regular practice can be something that is really powerful in sort of like filling your vitality bucket. I guess what's interesting to me is that there seem to be some conflicting data. I'm actually curious what your lens is on this. Maybe you actually have more recent information on this than I do, since you're sort of in the academic space around it. But there seemed to be sort of a bit of a split in sort of the best way to do this or the frequency to do it. And I spoke to this a bit in my book, but I'm actually really curious what your latest thoughts are on this too.
Oh, well, I think the gratitude journal is still very helpful. And, you know, keeping a daily reflection of who do you have gratitude for in your life, and as well as like the three good things, is still holds up scientifically. And you don't mention it as the three good things, but you mention the exercise, absolutely. And I loved how a lot of people miss out on the dual aspects of the three good things. It's not only what are the three good things happening, but also what are the things that were negative, and then how can you frame it? Like, what could you learn in a positive way from them? And a lot of people don't get that element into it, but that seems to be a really crucial part of it.
Yeah, no, I love that too. And I mean, the other thing that I spoke to in the book, and I've actually seen so much less attention to this, maybe because it takes more effort, is the idea of the gratitude visit, you know, where you actually sit there and you write something to someone who's been meaningful to you, and then you make the time to actually be with them, to share it with them. That, from what I've seen, is can be really profound. But I guess my sense is people don't reference that nearly as much because it just takes a bit more effort to make it happen.
I think so. Yeah, but it still doesn't mean that, you know, it's worth the effort, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that research is still going strong. You know, when you talked about that description of waking up kind of in these two different paths, kind of you wake up in the morning and you're just controlled by everything external, like the email and your mother and whatever. And I don't think you use the mother example. That's just my personal example. You know, versus being fully alive. Now, I really would like to know, on a personally, do you, that seems like such an ideal way of living. How close do you personally get to that? I mean, it sounds delightful if, you know, kind of being able to do that second scenario you described.
And it's interesting because I certainly aspire to be that person, but of course, I'm utterly human. I have a family, I have, you know, deadlines and stuff that happens. So that's not my 100% reality. But what I will say is that I really do try and move through each day as intentionally as possible. And I do wake up every morning. And the first thing that I do is I have a morning ritual. And, you know, the centerpiece of that morning ritual is a seated mindfulness practice. And that really sets in motion the rest of the day for me to focus a lot more on being intentional and less reactive. And in fact, I have a bit of a daily challenge every morning in that I use an app on my phone as the timer for my meditation practice. And the icon for the app sits immediately above the icon for my email and right next to the icon for, you know, my Instagram. Uh-huh. So, and it's funny because logic would say, well, I should just put those things, those temptations in the farthest screen on my phone. And I haven't done that because I kind of feel like the first, it's sort of like it sets me up so that even before I choose to sit and in my meditation, there is the slightest intentional act that precedes it, which is I have to look at my phone. I have to see that I get to make a choice. And then I have to choose not to check my email or not to check Instagram or some other social app, and just to tap the button, which says, okay, it's time to sit and it's time to practice. And as much as, you know, I sometimes get really tempted, I feel like it's actually important for me to just start my day with that single choice because it sets things up a little bit differently.
Do you do the mindful? Do you listen to the mindfulness meditation that you recorded with your own voice?
You know, it's funny. In the early days, I listened to me a little bit, odd as that sounds. I listened to a bunch of other people. I happen to love
awkward.
Yeah, a little bit, right? Tara Brach has wonderful guided stuff. You know, like I've got guided meditations for other people. My friend Susan Piver has this beautiful weekly meditation that she guides people at the Open Heart Project.
Cool.
But for years now, I don't have it guided. You know, I've been meditating for long enough now so that I actually prefer to just sit and sort of let my inner wisdom guide me.
I like that. How many minutes a day on average do you meditate for?
I generally do a minimum of 25, so somewhere between 25 and 30. So the final chime goes off at 25, and I'll often sit for just a touch more than that. So what's interesting, I've been doing this for years now, and it's amazing that I find it takes a good solid chunk of those 20 minutes for me to just kind of start to find some window of stillness in the practice. And, you know, what you learn is that there's, you know, that magical state where your mind just goes clear and you're able to let every thought go miraculously the moment it happens. And come back to this centered, open, and aware state. Maybe that happens if you devote your life to practice in a monastic setting, but in everyday life, you know, that doesn't really happen. So my commitment is really just to make sure that I'm sitting every day.
That's great. I really appreciate that you're very honest and human about that. You know, there's some people, well, especially, you know, monks and people who have been meditating for so long that it can kind of seem very unattainable. You know, I know this one monk who was in the fMRI scanner and was able to be in there for like 5 hours meditating, you know, Matthieu Ricard. And it's like, wow, you know, like, I mean, being in an fMRI machine and meditating, you know, for that many hours.
You know, yeah. It's interesting, though. I've actually had a couple of MRIs over the last few years. Yeah. And the way, and I think one actually lasted close to an hour. The way that I actually was okay in it was I did a mindfulness practice the entire time I was in it. And so these large sort of like banging, clunking, whirring, buzzing noises that happened, you know, while you're essentially in this tube where there's an inch of room all around you, it made it so that it was actually a weirdly calm place to be.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good test. If you can meditate in an fMRI machine, that I'm proud of you. That speaks highly of your practice. So I want to talk about another thing to fill up your vitality bucket, which relates to your prior book, and that's owning the unknown.
Yeah.
This is a theme that you've been really interested in for a while, right?
I have, yeah. You know, and I think it's a very personal one for me because I've been an entrepreneur the better part of my life and also an artist on some level the better part of my life.
Oh, what kind of art? What kind of artist?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I painted a ton with acrylics and oils, and then I built a lot of stuff. And then I started to leave it all behind, and you know, my art form, main form of expression really became writing. And literally just this week, I started to go back to the studio and do studio time for, I'm learning watercolors right now, which is really frustrating because I've never worked with him before. And it's not the easiest medium to just sort of like jump in and pick up. But what I learned along that is that, you know, you have to be able to exist in this place of not knowing and just continuing to work and do the work and experimenting. And you do that for sometimes years. And then over time, even when you develop that sense of taste that Ira Glass has famously talked about, you know, very often it's still years longer than that until you develop also the skills and the abilities to be able to express in the world that thing that you see in your mind. And it can be frustrating and you may not know exactly how to get there and you have to try a whole bunch of different things and invest yourself and resources, not knowing how it's going to work out. And if you're not okay going to that space where you have to take action and make choices without complete information and not knowing how it's going to end, it can not only be pretty devastating psychologically, but it can also just be pretty stifling in terms of you ever getting to a place where you feel like you're fully expressed, you're really contributing to the world in the most meaningful way possible.
Mm. Absolutely. So how does that relate to owning the unknown or being comfortable with unpredictability?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the best work that I found comes when you let go of certainty. So when you basically step out of that place and say, okay, I pretty much know how this is going to end. I know all the variables. It's really safe for me. And then you create within that realm. You generally don't create stuff that's all that satisfying for you or all that meaningful for anybody else. You know, the really creative stuff, the real form of innovation and expression and growth happens when you actually step out into the unknown where you don't know if you're going to succeed or fail. You don't know if you have the skills and abilities to make it happen or the resources. Yet you take action anyway, and you continue to sort of, you know, wade into the abyss. And the longer you're able to be in that place, what I've seen, both through my own experience and through interviewing a lot of people over the years now, is that if you, the longer you're in that space where you can continue to ask the questions and continue to make choices and continue to take action in that space of uncertainty, the more likely it is that you keep going deeper and deeper and getting to better and better ideas and better solutions. We see this in brainstorming. You know, there's sort of a three-phase approach to brainstorming. You know, phase one is you come up with all the obvious ideas, and that comes fairly quickly. And they're usually pretty mundane. It's not really the good stuff. And then some people will push through to phase two, and that's where it gets pretty hard and grueling. You feel like you have nothing left, and you don't know anymore, and you're on this really fragile ground. And you're exposed, and people hate being exposed because you don't know if you're going to be able to figure it out. But you start throwing out ideas, and they're better because you're working harder, you're going deeper. But as a general rule, even those ideas aren't the real sort of evolutionary innovative ones. And then a small number of people stay in this process long enough. They stay in that place of uncertainty and unknown long enough, and they endure it to a point where that next wave, the third wave of truly extraordinary, riveting, innovative ideas start to emerge. And that's the place where real magic takes hold in art, in innovation, in business, and in life. Yet most of us are so physically and psychologically uncomfortable staying in the process, taking action in the face of absolutely not knowing how it's going to end, that we run from it or we shut it down. So for me, you know, developing the ability to be in that place long enough for your greatest work to emerge is something that I just think is so empowering for anybody who's willing to do that work.
Absolutely. I love that. And fear and anxiety is definitely one of the major blockages to creativity. This relates to your excellent TEDx talk at my alma mater, Carnegie Mellon. Great talk. And the point of that, you know, major point of that talk is, you know, how you can kind of reframe your anxiety in a way that it could be a fuel for action. And I thought you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, and it's a really powerful and fairly straightforward technique, you know, in all sorts of different ways, worlds. People call it reframing. I guess more classically, it would be called cognitive reappraisal in the therapeutic world. But it starts with the understanding that whatever the story is you're telling in your head is very likely the story you're telling in your head, not the only story, and very likely also not the real story. And rather than saying, you know, most people ask the question, what if I fail? And then telling the failure story and painting this vivid doomsday scenario in their head and then hitting spin so that eventually they start to believe that's the only inevitable outcome. And that just that paralyzes you. It completely destroys the possibility of doing anything meaningful. So rather than doing that, I think it's important to ask that question. You know, you should actually look at the failure scenario. But that's where most people stop. And to me, that's actually the starting point. You know, so what we do is we add a series of questions to that. So then you add to that, well, and how will I recover? And then you actually, you plan this out, you know, and you paint this scenario. Okay, so if this happens, then here's how I'm actually going to recover and continue to move forward. And then you add to that two other questions. And then one is, what if I do nothing? And for most people, this is actually the most terrifying story that they'll tell. Because if they're not happy with the way their life is, their relationship, their career, whatever it may be, and they keep tracking that out, you know, in the sort of slow, gradual decline over a period of years, it's a devastating scenario if you're really honest about the story that that tells. So I think it's really important to get real about the inaction story as well. And then the final one is, what if I succeed? You know, and paint an equally vivid and beautiful picture about that. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. The TED Talk is a number of years old now, and this was just sort of stuff that came to me through my own work and talking to a lot of different people. I think looking back at that, those ideas or those questions, there's a really interesting overlay. It's funny, I actually didn't put this together until we're just talking this out right now. Cool. I think there's a really interesting overlay with Gabrielle, how do you pronounce her last name?
I just say Odingen.
Odingen. Gabrielle Odingen, sort of like whole whoop approach, you know.
Yeah, I love that you talk about whoop in your book.
Yeah. You know, because it's like, hey, listen, own the fact that stuff might get hard and plan, you know, actually plan how you're going to respond to it in advance so that if it does in fact happen, it's not going to wipe you out.
For sure. So all these things that we just talked about will help you build up your vitality bucket. Let's move on to your connection bucket. So what is a social set point? What does that mean?
Yeah. And you know, it's kind of interesting. What I've experienced in my own life and a lot of people that I've sort of worked with, and it seems like this is sort of emerging a bit in some of the research, is that we're all wired to a certain extent along a scale of introversion, ambiversion, and extroversion.
Where are you?
I am very much towards the introversion side of the scale. I'm curious about you.
Oh, I'm still trying to figure myself out. You know? I feel like, you know, like I feel like you give me two cups of coffee and I'm an extrovert, but my default feels introvert.
Yeah, no, I think my default definitely is. But what's interesting to me is I didn't really understand the difference until I just spent some time with Susan Cain, who we both know and who's written this wonderful book called Quiet. And when she really explained to me, like the real easiest way to explain it, I think, is that introverts are not anti, it's not that you're antisocial. You may well love people, but the way that you engage with them is different. So I love sort of smaller, more intimate individual or small group conversations. And it's not unusual for me if I'm around larger groups of people to be okay. But the big difference is that after that conversation, I'm generally left relatively empty. So I need to go step away from people in order to sort of refuel my tank. Whereas I have friends, actually colleagues, like on our team, who are raging extroverts. And the thing that fills them up more than anything else is being around large numbers of people. So, and this can be really, if you understand this about yourself, you can actually construct your life and your work life in a way that ends up being much more filling than emptying. So interesting example. We, not too long ago, every year we run a summer camp for adults where, you know, the better part of 400 people get on planes, trains, and automobiles to go and live communally for close to 4 days together. So it's 24/7, people from all over the world. And this, it's this amazing, amazing experience. But at the same time, how does somebody who's fairly introverted handle that? And so the way that we've kind of done it is that we've actually assembled a team fairly deliberately of pretty raging extroverts around us who, like, they kind of have two purposes. One is they serve as a bit of a buffer. But two is they go out and they are the happiest people in the world when they are the entertainers and they engage and they work with all these different people. So we actually build our experiences and our faculty in a way where we understand the social set points of the different people on the team and the social needs, what fills and empties each person. And we design the experiences and our teams to sort of allow for the best blend of leaving everybody as full as possible.
Well, the Quiet Revolution folks would love that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful that you take that into consideration. It'd be great if more businesses and schools took that into consideration.
Yeah, wouldn't it? And I guess that's what sort of Susan and the whole Quiet Revolution gang is working on now. So,
for sure.
I hope it gets the type of traction and attention that I really think it deserves.
Yeah, me too. I love this other one you talked about under that under the connection bucket. Finding your tribe, I would say, you know, but you say find your people. Yeah. So tell me why that's important.
Yeah, you know, one of the most fundamental human needs is the need to belong. And it's something that both isn't spoken about a whole lot these days, but of more concern to me is that the sort of traditional bastions of belonging, the things that provided this sense of belonging, are either going away or they're not providing the same thing anymore. So what are those things? Well, traditionally, it was faith-based organizations, it was employers, it was local trade groups or leagues. And, you know, local trade groups and leagues are largely vanishing these days. Employers generally, you know, there's such a short time span that the average person is at any one company that they're not all that invested in building or delivering a sense of belonging. And the single fastest growing group of people when it comes to faith or religion, at least in the United States, are what they call the nuns, meaning people who consider themselves spiritual but non-affiliated with any particular faith, and they don't attend a congregation or any sort of community. So, you know, we've got this need. We actually have a physiological and a psychological need to belong. We literally wither on the vine when we don't have...
When you said that, it was very profound. You had one line in that book where you're basically like, with isolation, you wither and die. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's fun because especially as an introvert, sometimes I get a little curmudgeonly. I'm like, I'm pretty good alone. But the truth is I'm not. You know, the truth is I love time in solitude, but I have to have my time that's nourishing in my community where, you know, I'm around people who are like-minded, share a set of values and beliefs, share similar aspirations and a similar ethos about what matters in the world. And that's why a lot of what we do also, we build community. We tend to build a lot of our programming so that even if it's a product or even if it's a book, you know, like we're building a community around our entire company and around this book because to me, information isn't enough. Knowing what to do isn't enough. Community and building that sense of belonging, there's such a profound gap that is growing in people's lives these days that I kind of feel like part of what we're here to do is help close that gap, is help, you know, give people something to belong to. And at the same time, I also feel like there's not really a lot of attention being given to this phenomenon of the profound need to belong and the solutions, you know, solving for belonging, not really happening on the level that it used to anymore. And I think a lot of people are walking around feeling a sense of pain, feeling a sense of isolation, and not really understanding where it's coming from. And a lot of it is coming from the fact that they no longer have a clear place to belong to, a clear community or a group of people. And it's really, I think it can be really destructive in a lot of people's lives, you know. So I wouldn't be surprised if even there was a certain amount of, you know, self-medication through everything from materialism to other stuff, literally because people have felt so isolated and removed from that sense of belonging and community.
I mean, it's a really great point. And I think you see that when some of these, I would call them needs, are not being met, that they can play themselves out in other areas. So there are some people who really have a hard time connecting individually to people, but they will fill up their contribution bucket in a way that kind of fulfills that need because they feel like they've created something that really helps a lot of people. And it kind of makes them feel like more of a connection in that way, right?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be true. You know, I think, and it's funny, it's almost like, you know, when you look at two toddlers, they go through this early phase where they're kind of sitting next to each other on the floor and they know that they're there and they're both playing and they're both giggling, but they're not actually playing with each other. And they call it parallel play.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, you know, I don't even know if you have to be interacting with each other, but just sort of like knowing that you're there with others who sort of like are at a similar point and sort of see the world similarly, and you're just kind of physically with them. I think that alone has a certain value as well.
Absolutely. So with the connection, when you talk about some other things that are just so important, and I want people to read your book, so I'm not going to give it all away, but this one just resonated with me so much. Vanquishing the vampires in your life. I mean, I think a lot of people can really resonate with that. You know, sometimes I think we all kind of get stuck. It can feel like we're stuck with people in our lives that don't make us feel vital, right? So like the other buckets as well are not, you know, happening. So what do you do about that?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's one of the biggest challenges for so many people. And the truth is there's no easy answer, but I think there's a preliminary question that can be really helpful, which is how critical are these people in your life? You know, there's sort of a popular self-help wisdom that says just jettison anyone from your life who doesn't automatically love you up and agree 100% with everything that you want to do. And yeah, that's just the reality on the ground is, you know, once you reach a certain point in your life, especially, you know, those people may be your close family. They may be your close friends. They may just disagree with you. You know, although they may also be at a point where their just lens on the world is so different from yours that being around them is very emptying and not all that filling. So I think part of it is understanding what's this person's role and value in your life, and do you want to keep them in your life because they're important to you? Or not even do you want to keep them, but they are going to be in your life for as long as you're both around. So then, you know, like if the answer to that question is yes, then it makes sense to actually say, hey, listen, you know, like I'm sure you sense something here, but this is going well. And I feel like when we're around each other, we're both essentially emptying each other out. You know, so before you just go say, hey, listen, like you need to be out of my life, really understand what's the deeper nature of this relationship. And is it something where actually it makes sense to have a more deliberate conversation before you just sort of like start jettisoning people out of there? Because there will be, and then if, you know, if the answer is, well, I can't remove this person from my life, but they're still really, you know, there's a draining energy when I'm around them. Then the question becomes, how can you create enough of a buffer in the way that you interact with them so that it does the least amount of harm? And then how can you really, really, really focus heavily on your own self-care so that it fills you as much as humanly possible to give you sort of the biggest possible reserve to be able to respond to that person? And then there's a third thing also, which is a longer term practice, which is really developing almost a loving kindness and a sort of a compassion-based practice and really trying to understand what's making this person this way. And like, can I stand in their shoes and find a place of compassion for them rather than just sort of like judgment and a fierce desire to remove them from my existence?
Yes. There we go again with your interaction between the buckets. Like you can imagine the more vital you are, the more you can withstand vampires in your life because you've built up that inner reserve.
Yeah.
So, and also, mindfulness.
And mindfulness
as well.
Yeah. Mindful is huge because.
Did we say that at the same time?
Right, we did, I think.
That's a great connection.
Right, right. So total attunement there. Yeah, because, you know, if you're the more part of the mindfulness practice is the practice of dropping, you know, and it allows you to say, oh, wait a minute, like, let me just drop that storyline. Let me just drop that. If I'm really annoyed, you know, this is actually an internal process for me right now. I'm the one who's spinning it in my head, even though this happened hours ago. And that mindfulness practice, it trains you to be able to recognize that spin cycle and step out of it much more readily.
Sounds good to me. So for the last part of this interview, just a couple more minutes here, I want to talk about the contribution bucket. And this is where meaning and purpose comes into one's life. And, you know, a lot of people do have that thing where they say, I don't know what it is that I like. I want to be sparked. I want to have that spark, but I'm kind of missing it. What would you recommend for people like that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's been a bit of a maniacal focus on, like, you have to find the thing that you're on the planet to do
right.
over the last chunk of years.
No pressure, no pressure.
Right, this singular life purpose, the thing that one passion that you're here to do, which I think can be so destructive for so many people. It's been my experience, it's just a practical matter, that on really rare occasion, you do find people who really early in life, they stumble upon that one thing, and that's the thing they do for life. My dad, interestingly, is probably one of those people. He had one job for his entire life that he literally just retired from, I think, 2 years ago. And he actually researched human cognition and he ran a lab, and that's what he did. And that was his mad passion. And it still is, even though he's retired from academic life. You know, but that's really unusual. Most people end up running a series of experiments to try and figure it out. So to me, a much better approach is to ask yourself, what can I do, or what do I do that gives me a sense of passion or a sense of purpose? You know, what sparks me is sort of the language that I use. And I've sort of found like these five different categories of sparks. In my mind, there's a curiosity spark, which is really, you know, it's like you're driven by a question, a fierce need to figure out the answer to a question. You're deeply curious about something. There's a fascination spark, just you're completely and utterly fascinated by a particular, very often it's a topic or an idea, and it's not necessarily about figuring out an answer to a problem. You want to go deep into this topic or this area or this field. There are immersion sparks that just drop you deep into a state where you love the feeling that you get when you're exploring it. There are mastery sparks where it's really about a deliberate quest to reach a state of mastery. And there are service sparks, and these are generally fueled by some sort of deep inner calling to be of service. Sometimes it's in general. Other times it may be to a particular person or community. And of course, you know, there are some people that are strongly fueled by one of these, but there are also people where there's all different blends of it. So my lens tends to be more to start to ask yourself these questions. You know, when I think about the things that have really lit me up in life, what generally have they been, or that are lighting me up now? You know, am I driven deeply to answer a particular question? This is your typical scientist. You know, am I driven by a topic? So, and if you can find sort of the spark or the type of spark that really incites this sense of passion, this sense of purpose, and just literally wake up and do more of that every day, you find yourself doing that for days and then months and then years and then looking back decades. And you end up having lived a life pretty filled with purpose and passion. And you never had to deal with that sort of, I think, false question of what is my, you know, like, what is my passion or purpose as a noun? You treat it much more as a verb and say, what do I do with passion and purpose?
Dang. I want some of that. No, that sounds really great. So along this quest of getting your passion and purpose, you're going to have lots of distractions, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of critically important. And it kind of circles back to what we were talking about. So much circles back to mindfulness and awareness. The average person lives a largely reactive life right now. You know, from the moment you open your eyes to the moment you go to bed, there will be people and entities and beings, be they friends, you know, like colleagues, employers, family, all coming at you through technology, through interactions face-to-face, through so many different ways, asking for bits of your time and bits of your energy. And that's how wonderful is it to have people who would like you involved in what they're doing? You know, at the same time, very often, almost out of a sense of social obligation, we tend to just say yes, or out of an almost autopilot addiction to the intermittent reinforcement dopamine hits of technology, we end up actually just responding almost maniacally without actually even thinking about it or being deliberate in any way, shape, or form. And we end up spending our days literally almost entirely reactively, reacting to the demands and agendas and requests of other people. And we go to bed at night saying, wow, you know, like wall to wall, I was really busy, but I didn't actually end up doing anything that mattered to me on a deep level. And I think we've lost the ability to say no. Part of it is technology induced, but part of it is also there's just culturally an expectation of yes these days, instant and yes, that can be pretty compounding in its devastation because it stops you from actually preserving the bandwidth needed to do the things that are deeply meaningful to you, the things that actually fill your buckets on a daily basis. So, you know, literally being intentional and hitting pause and practicing saying no on a daily basis is a huge skill set that I don't think we focus on enough. I've actually sent emails in response to people who requested time from me or help from me, where, you know, I say, hey, listen, you know, like, thank you so much for the invitation to participate in this. It sounds fantastic. Sadly, I'm already committed to things that are, you know, like, deeply meaningful to me and that are taking, you know, already 150% of my time. So I have to decline your invitation. And I've had people respond to me and say, you know, one, you know, of course I was kind of upset because I would have loved for this to work, but at the same time, I really respect the fact that you're prioritizing the things that really matter to you. And you're actually making me think about me maybe needing to do something similar.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of cool to see when that happens.
Living by example. It's great.
Yeah.
And you refer to this as the loving no.
Yeah.
And I like that too. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Because, you know, it's all you got. I mean, for me, it's always about mindfulness and compassion. You know, like, understand, people aren't just trying to extract the world from you. Like, everyone is trying to do their good work here. And so kindness is really important in my mind, you know, no matter what scenario you're in.
I love that. I just have one final question I want to ask you today. And, you know, a lot of these things you talk about with filling up these buckets, why is it not directly, you know, why not write a book on happiness or how to get more money? You know, why on a good life? What's the difference?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you certainly spend a chunk of time on this research too. And there have certainly been so many books on happiness over the last decade or so. And I think the topic has been extraordinarily well covered. But part of what the research is uncovering is that when you make actually attaining happiness as the primary end state, it's not unusual for you to actually end up less happy than where you started. And, you know, so part of it is the fact that this sort of maniacal pursuit of happiness can set up expectations for an end state that's not attainable and leave you kind of anxious and stressed. Part of it is also that there is, you know, at least the research that I've been exposed to shows that we're not 100% in control of that thing called, quote, happiness. That, you know, there are certain things that we can do, but at the same time, there's a certain amount, it's almost like a genetic set point for happiness that we tend to revert to. So to sort of say, okay, my happy should look like the happy of this person over here who's constantly bouncing off the walls and like wakes up smiling all the time and then never being able to reach that because genetically you're just kind of wired a bit differently can set you up to actually feel even worse about the whole thing. And then there's a third confounding variable here, which is that it's really hard to understand what anybody's actually talking about when we use the word happy. You know, this is why in the research, you know, nobody defines happiness. You know, nobody defines the state of happiness. You know, generally the questions are asking people, have they laughed in the last 24 hours or have they been happy? But you can't give a universal objective description of it. So we end up with literature that's really fascinating, but at the same time, there is this big sort of gray indefinable in the middle, which is what does it actually mean to be happy? So to me, you know, from what I've seen, the things that deliver people to this state that we call happy the most effectively are pursuing relationships, pursuing connection, pursuing meaning. And what tends to happen is that this state of happiness ensues more as a side effect or a byproduct of those other things rather than trying to sort of pursue it as a direct outcome and then very often ending up less happy than when we started.
Absolutely. I totally love that, Jonathan. And I really like your book and the work you're doing. Thanks for chatting with me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.